Welcome to the Tombstone Kings of Queens. Due to adult language and violent nature of the stories told, listener discretion is strongly advised.
Episode 1. Duty Bound.
Ever since making the bargain, I can't bring myself to kill cockroaches no more. I capture them under a cup and find myself taking a minute, feeling the tickling of its frantic legs on my hand. I realize at that moment that I have all the power, the keys to the kingdom, life and death. Just because I can kill it doesn't mean I need to, but then I have that luxury. If the roles were ever reversed, would the cockroach think of sparing me? My name is Robbie Crutch. Like most of you listening to this, I died, and it didn't stick. Trying to piece together a few things over the last few days, like why I keep finding post-it notes in my pockets in my own handwriting that read 5:15, like AM or PM. Last time I went to the Flesh Fair, they warned me of this. Memory lapses. That's why they asked me to keep an eye on Nyx. Sometimes, when we don't agree with our Geist, they'll take our bodies for a spin without us even knowing it. Then you have some alien junkie for life living you raw. Not so much burning the candle at both ends as greasing it with gasoline and tossing the whole damn thing into a bonfire. I just gotta keep a straight head. And apparently a pen handy at all times. Sometimes that happens to us. Two souls, one body. Sometimes we fight for control. It's part of the fine print on the bargain no one tells you about. You're just so desperate to live when they offer it to you, you just say yes. I want to see the general as a partner, rather than a landlord or a tool. Or even a parasite. But I guess he and I will cross that bridge when he tries to burn it down. Found some new graffiti on my block. This one read, "First estate fell like shadows, the crow be crowned by new moon." Up on the fourth floor, bright greens and reds. I saw it this morning as I passed by the park on my way to the train. The park was calm. Stroller so big the NYPD could give him an orange ticket. Small terrier mixes barking at each other. Hispanic and black nannies standing around the benches. The swing sets were empty, despite all the kids. Which told me Amy was still there. Still mad. Last few days I've been trying to figure out what to do with Amy. 11-year-old girl strangled in the park. Left a pretty potent death stain on the neighborhood. Kids can already see her at night. But during the day, she just pushes the swing something fierce and makes the south entrance cold. I don't think she's a threat. She's too young, too fresh. Means she could make mistakes. I know I'm not the only one watching her either. I've been wanting to try diplomacy, but she'll flick her out whenever I try to speak with her. And it's a real shame sometimes. Because they're so stuck in their patterns, the dead. They don't realize that we're the only ones who get the message. We're the only ones willing to listen, trying to help. I figure if I don't help her move on, someone else will cut in line and banish her, destroy her corpus, or worse. Every time I walk all the way to Leslie's house, I get lost. He lives in those 1900s brick houses, the ones you can't change on the outside on account of them being historical landmarks. Classic black iron fences and yards all connected behind by narrow paths of concrete overtaken by ivy and kudzu. I look for homes I recognize. I look for landmarks, like the tree that grew over the fire hydrant, the house with the Islamic crescent moon on the red door. Then at least I know I'm on the necromancer's block. He was in the basement, of course. First beautiful spring day of the year, and he's already 6 feet under like a studious little bookworm. Thin, trimmed goatee, and beard that ends on a point. Vest and tie, despite the warmth. Perfectly manicured hands. He's never happy to see me. And I'm never happy to see who he's got cooling on the slab. Today he has a man's body on the table in his basement, surrounded by clipped industrial lights. Little underweight, already blue-lipped and white-skinned, maybe early 20s, maybe mid. Leslie says, as always, that he's busy. He tells me I missed Kali by about 10 minutes. He grabs chalk and draws some hybrid of calligraphy and hieroglyphics on the table around the head and around the hands. He dabs some rum between the corpse's eyes, then behind the ears like he's anointing the poor bastard. I ask him if he'll help me with Amy. He ignores me, of course, pricks his finger, draws an X of blood on the corpse's bare chest. Leslie says it's my neighborhood, so it's up to me. When I look around, the corpse on the table has his eyes and mouth wide open, looking straight at me. It sits up. Leslie speaks calmly to it, asks the body if it remembers anything, if it knows who he is. After a moment, the corpse realizes that it's missing a leg. It points, cries out with tortured, borrowed breath, then tries to roll off the table. When it crashes, it goes limp again. I see its breath, a weak pip of gray fog, leak from its head and evaporate like steam. Leslie takes the failure in stride, makes a mark on some papers, sips his mint tea, and forcibly exhales. He says calmly, "Didn't stick." Maybe to himself, maybe to the pale angel, certainly not to me. He's been at the Frankenstein thing since I've known him. Probably been doing it ever since he rose from his own slab back in the 80s. He says he got it to work once, but it got complicated. He never said anything past that. It can't be easy being what he is, let alone a necromancer on top of that. When we first teamed up, I got to read some of his essays. He once wrote that when he came out of the closet, he felt relieved. Not because he was finally honest with the homophobes and ready to take them head on, but because he was already abnormal. For the time he came out, gays were the terrorists of the early 90s, at least where I come from. So whatever else he'd become, sin-eater, zombie-maker, ghostbuster, was just icing on an already weird cake. I break him from his trance and I ask again if he'll help me put Amy to rest. "If you want to get rid of the girl's ghost," he tells me, "then banishment is the fastest way, Robbie. Least that way she'll end up in the underworld where she belongs. Then at least you can visit her whenever you want." "She was strangled at 11 years old," I say. "I think she's been through enough. I want it to be peaceful. I'm not into conjugal visits with dead people." He stares at me and I stop. Shitty thing to say. That time I went too far. I knew I went too far. "And if she asks you to find her killer, are you willing to turn the whole city into a Charles Bronson movie just to appease one new ghost? Use your head, Robbie. You're the sin eater, so eat the sin." I hate when he suggests that we eat him. It's the most gruesome, unfair, and natural way we have to process a spirit. That's what Leslie wanted me to do. The option just never sits right with me. I mean, pet shelters have to put down animals all the time. Doesn't make it right. Just another option. "Can't you please come with me to do some kind of purifying ritual? Something to help her pass on? She's just a kid." "Then find something she's fettered to and keep it in your back pocket for all I care. Take her to Sesame Place or a boy band concert. Can't we make a new fetter or something? I've seen you do it before. I make him look at the museum. That's his nickname for the oak display cabinet that runs the entire length of his basement wall. With all his efforts and research, I know he can bind anyone to anything, so long as you have the resources and are willing to pay the price. I've held down enough of his bucking zombies to know that. Leslie tells me that he won't leave his house tonight. Something about his anniversary. He already has the upstairs table set for two, and his antique record player moaning out Glenn Miller upstairs in preparation. I take it he won't be accepting any phone calls tonight, which means I'm on my own. Leslie turns to me again, but still not making eye contact.
When you're at the top of the food chain, you have the luxury of time. You get to decide when and what you eat.
I'll make a few phone calls to another crew, the ambulance chasers. Most of them work at Mount Sinai Hospital and as part-time paranormal paramedics, so they keep up to date on when coolers arrive. Or leave. At least the reported ones. Now, with their help and some newspaper articles, I find out the details of Amy's death. Amy and her mother shared a one-bedroom in Woodside Lawns. About 2 weeks ago, someone followed her mother home, kicked in the door, tied up Amy's mom, who remains comatose at the hospital from a head injury. Ambulance chasers are keeping a close eye on her. But this is the weird part. Security footage from the liquor store across the street shows Amy and someone walking into the park. Middle of the night, holding hands. Footage is too blurry and too dark to make out anything else, but it's them, all right. Amy must have known her killer. But how familiar were they? To leave her mother behind? But if she were in the apartment while her mother was... I don't want to think about it, but part of my duty as a sin eater is that I have to. There's something foul about this whole situation. I ask around her building, find the apartment, tell the super I'm a concerned uncle. Of course, NYPD hasn't even had time to strip and clean the place. Nobody even gave me a second glance as I opened the door and came inside the tiny tenement. Ghost sight didn't show anything, even in twilight. Her mother had already been removed, but most of the broken furniture still lay about the floor. I entered Amy's bedroom, found a photo of her and her mom, looks like kindergarten graduation, and the only doll I could find. Hopefully one of these could be a strong enough fetter to resolve her and help her move on. By this point, the sun was already setting, so I headed back to the park to put this girl, who life had preyed upon without any remorse, at rest. It's a long walk up the avenue. Projects, dollar stores, liquor stores, corner bodegas, and a laundry place, which I never see people in, I just assume it's a money laundering operation. When I get within two blocks, I see nobody's in the park. But the swing set is going something wild. Dust and leaves are exploding into flurries. In the middle, swinging wildly like she's fighting the invisible man, is Callie. Callie, my teammate, is fighting something. That's when the panic hits me. I figured Callie was fighting tooth and claw against some underworld escapee or cannibalistic specter that's had Amy in its sight for days. Stupid. Stupid! I let this happen! She's fighting something in the Twilight Realm,
Anything that lives in that half-world between worlds is old, patient, hungry, and really eager for company. I call out to the general in my mind, and he obliges. I feel the bloody film cover my eyes, and when I possess him, the world goes foggy and colorless, save for the park. Callie is young, but has a pretty good relationship with her Geist, the conductor. And when it comes to a fight, they're scrappy as all hell. As I run across the street, some trees and the gate block my vision. Callie's arm lights up in ghostly green flames, and she launches a stream at whatever was attacking Amy. I call to Callie. She doesn't respond, just crouches low and folds her arms over her head. I'm so distracted by the transition into twilight, I barely dodge the car crossing the street as it honks at me. In the gray haze of the half-world, I see some flickering, smoky remnants leap into Callie's mouth. And she doubles over, even like she's holding back vomit. Then she stands up perfectly straight again, perfectly calm. I look around. No attacker. No Amy. She won.
What did you just do?
I demand. Callie wipes her mouth with the back of her fist and looks at me hard. I see the outline of the conductor behind her stand up straight. Hear the Doppler effect of a rusty underground train and I smell burnt rubber. There was a stain growing across their shared aura. Deep black lines like veins flowing between the two of them. Quickest way to power is often the ugliest. They're both flexing their muscles, still grasping those fight or flight instincts. Her name is Pura Shahada. When she was 17, she moved to New York City from India for school to become a civil engineer, learning how to build bridges, tunnels, public transit. By the time Leslie talked her into joining the Tombstone Kings, she and the conductor had already taken down some raging poltergeists in Red Hook, earning her the nickname Kali, Indian goddess of destruction.
I did not hear you call dibs on her.
Her voice was flat. The necklace she wears, the gift from the conductor, the one made of greasy old subway tokens, starts jingling and levitating off her neck.
Did you just fucking eat her?
I said, taking another step toward her, showing her the doll in the photo.
I just brought this from her home. The violence wasn't necessary.
That's pretty rich, coming from one of the Tarn,
she says. I can hear a steady drumbeat and a stamping sound like marching in the back of my head. And I know the general is about as pissed as I am. Callie spits.
Go fuck yourself. If you're not gonna do your job, then I will. And before you know it, I'll be more powerful than you. Then you'll think twice about cursing at me.
A lot of people will tell you how much of a dog-eat-dog world it is. Normally, with a collar and chunk of fur flying from their foamy maw. I used to think, because we all start as people, that Sin Eaters were supposed to have better judgment than this. I hear the tinny echo of the General's voice in my ears. Now there's a lot that we disagree on, but he and I see eye to eye when it comes to justice. Callie was hyped on the power she just absorbed. I don't know if you've ever seen something so black it glows, but those were Pura's eyes. Before I was able to go stone skin and wail on her, though, she had the conductor launch a parked moped at me square in the chest. I get crunched between a moped and a fucking tree right behind me. I hear the rib crack before I feel it. The air rushes out of me. But she's keeping the fight outside, and that's gonna be her mistake. She's standing on bare earth. I'm about to punch the ground and crush her. I'm about to fill her lungs with gravel and make her think she's already 6 feet under. I'm about to make her bleed out with a touch. I want to hurt her very, very badly.
But I see the broken pieces of Amy's doll, broken and twisted on the ground. And the fight just leaves me. Even with the trumpets of the general blaring this war cry in my head, I let Amy's second killer walk away scot-free. Just got off the phone with Leslie. Oddly enough, he called me. Like an idiot, I asked how dinner went.
Didn't take.
That must hurt. Setting up a table and your guest of honor doesn't even show up. It's part of life. I'm gonna call Nix in a bit. See how she's doing. If she don't pick up, I'll call the bar across the street from her place and see how she's really doing. But later tonight, I'm gonna take the pieces of the doll, and I'm gonna burn them in that outdoor grill in the park. Say a proper eulogy and goodbye to little Amy. It's not worth staying mad at Kali. I know a better place to invest my anger. Borrowed time or not, I'm gonna find that girl's murderer, and I'ma show him that justice can trail you just as patiently, steadily, and finally as death itself.
The Tombstone Kings of Queens is written by Uncle Yo, produced by Jimmy Lin and Uncle Yo.
And don't forget, original music produced by Jimmy Lin.
Special thanks to Onyx Path Publishing and White Wolf Publishing for the chance to haunt a whole new world of darkness. Comments? Questions? Suggestions? Join us on facebook.com/UncleYo or check us out on patreon.com/UncleYo and help keep the Twilight Network in touch. Game on, include everybody, and remember that death is only the beginning.